It's 8 o'clock. Isn't this supposed to be a net? Let's back off. WT2YK.
Yes, sir. K2 Romeo India Whiskey here. My name is Dick, along with Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick tried to orchestrate a thing called the Technical Man. We bring guys together on Sunday evening for the last 27 years, and they try to help each other. There's lots to learn about ham radio, and therefore this is one of the places where an awful lot of information is disseminated. A person signs into the Technical Med by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. And the word yes means you do have a question, or a comment for the net. If you're just listening, you need not sign in. By now, after 27 years, we believe people in the tri-state area are listening. So give me your call letters and name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
November to X-ray, Juliet, November, Wesley, yes.
Here, mobile in West Hampton, and I have a quick question.
West Hampton, we missed the beginning of your call letters and name, so wait a couple of seconds, and then after you start transmitting, and then give us that information again, sir. Your call letters and your name.
Whiskey 2, Charlie Yankee Kilo on mobile, Bob in West Hampton. Good evening, Dick. Good evening to the neck. Net, just have a quick one when you get a second, all right?
Okay. You're the doctor. Whiskey 2, Charlie Yankee. What was that again? Is that Bob?
Yes, it is. It is Bob. Charlie Yankee Kilowatt.
Okay, Bob. So we've got Wesley and Bob. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
This is KC2SYL Bill No.
W2TRP2N Paul Ball.
Good evening, Dick. With a yes because of the space report. Good evening.
We got Bill with a no, Bill number two, Paul with a yes, and Mr. TRP, give me your name, and did you give me a yes?
W2TRP, yes, I have one question. Irwin.
Okay.
K2KEYN, can I say something, Dick?
Go right ahead and say something, Mel.
All right, I've been inundated with a question that maybe you can leave some time because it's come up to the point where I had it today on 10-meter net in the morning, also phone calls, emails and all, and to try to straighten out one thing I think that we have touched upon, Balaams. But there seems to be a lot of misconceptions, and I did make a statement today, and I got phone calls about it, and so maybe we can... sort of, you know, iron this out so it's possible to leave some substantial time towards the end over.
Reasonable request, Mel. Balun, B-A-L-U-N or B-A-L-U-U-N, depending on how you spell it. A device that goes between a balanced and unbalanced transmission line, and or it can be doing impedance matching at the same time. So, darn good subject. Not very well understood. We're going to cover that one. So far, we've got check-ins from Wesley, Bob, let's see, Bill with a no, Paul with a yes, and Irwin with a yes. Anyone else to check-in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Me to all I want. No questions.
And Joe recognized. Let's start off with Wesley. N2XJN. What's happening in Queens tonight, Wesley? K2RIW. You've got it, sir.
Good afternoon. This is November 2, X-ray Juliet November. Name is Wesley in here, and I'm in Queens. Well, I'd like to pick up the subject of if two is a sense of there is a complete nonsense to put 1 kilowatt amplifier into your car for the HF and 6 meters? And the second question is, why then the manufacturing of various numbers of amplifiers started in the 60s and end up in early 80s, and there is no more on the market? Back to you, Antoine Zay.
Very fine, Leslie. At one time, I did contemplate putting a kilowatt amplifier on 6 meters in my automobile. And at that time, well, this is lots of years ago, I was a strong enthusiast of using 4CX250B external anode forced air-cooled tubes, because they were so high in gain, so inexpensive in price, so high in performance, good to 500 megacycles, and looked like it'd be a great way to go. To properly use that tube requires a plate supply of 2,000 volts at half an ampere to be a kilowatt of input. And to build that kind of a power supply in an automobile is not easy. I never did follow through with that particular project. I do know of a man who picked up on the surplus market a 800-watt solid-state amplifier for 2 meters. And he used to drive home to Port Jefferson each night from New York City with his 800-watt amplifier. Let me drop. And when it comes to talking to the repeater, he had rather good coverage on this machine, among other machines, all the way to Port Jefferson, which is about 60 or 70 miles east of New York City, with his 800-watt amplifier. He was a little bit of an alligator as opposed to a rabbit. That's the slang we use for somebody who is stronger and he's got a bigger mouth and a set of ears, so to speak. That's an alligator. So there were times when he was not hearing everything from the repeater, particularly if he was driving alongside of a automobile with noisy ignition system. But we heard him, and he was doing that for about 6 months. And then he went kind of quiet because the alternator on his automobile failed on him. In order to run 800 watts solid state at 12 volts, and I believe it was a 12-volt amplifier, because they rarely run much more than about 50% efficiency, he has to be putting close to 1600 watts input. So he was probably drawing something like 130 amperes at 12 volts. And even if it was a one of these amplifiers that runs on 24 or 28 volts, and he was using some kind of a step-up device, if that was running at high efficiency, still at the 12-volt level, he'd be drawing, again, something like 130 or so amperes. Most alternators on an automobile can only put out about 100 amperes maximum. So therefore, during the time he was transmitting, the alternator was running flat out, and he's drawing at least another 30 amperes from the battery, as if nothing else in electrical equipment in the car was running. Let me drop. So, there's about three or four issues you should consider, in my opinion, before putting an 800-watt or 1,000-watt amplifier on 6 meters or 2 meters or 450 in your automobile. Current drain and whether or not the battery and alternator and whatever can tolerate it is one issue. This was back in the days, this was in the late 80s when this guy was doing it. Since the late 80s, our automobiles almost all have an emission control computer. That's the only way the automobile manufacturer can come close to meeting the specifications for miles per gallon, the emissions from the automobile being correct. When you order an increase in acceleration because you're pressing down on the gas pedal, the computer, called emission control computer, is balancing mixture, it's controlling the amount of air, the amount of injection of fuel, it's looking at the oxygen sensor, it's doing a whole lot of things. And so that emission control computer, if there is a close to 1,000-watt amplifier on board, which the manufacturer of the automobile will never guarantee that it's going to have proper operation of that computer with that amount of RF energy nearby. So whether or not the transmitter, when it's keyed, could it confuse the computer and create one of these conditions we've been hearing about recently, where the throttle goes wide open and the car goes into a runaway condition? That's something to consider. So current drain, upset of the emission control computer and or instrument panel, that's issue number two. Issue number three, let me drop. Issue number three is radio frequency biohazard. When you're running 50 watts from an antenna on a quarter wave whip or a 5/8 wave whip on the top of the automobile, under reasonable conditions, in my opinion, that's safe. However, if you decide to stand with your foot on the edge of the car and one foot on the ground with the door open, and your head is only a foot or two away from that antenna, and you're putting 1,000 watts into it, now you're on the threshold of not being safe as far as radio frequency biohazard is concerned, in my opinion. The good news is that the specification is done for a 6-minute period, because the eye is the most vulnerable part of a human being, and you can't heat up an eye instantaneously. You could say the eye appears to have a thermal time constant of something like 6 minutes. So if you're doing a long transmission and standing there like I just described, I don't think it's safe. Inside of the car, because you get a moderate amount of shielding on the assumption you've got a metal roof and there's a mag mount or something like that on the top of the car, that may be safe. But to be really conservative, you should make a measurement of how many milliwatts per square centimeter is your body being exposed to inside the car when you key that transmitter. So there's a lot of issues. The good news is putting out that kind of power would make you a pretty potent mobile, and lots of people will hear you very well. But there are three issues I've mentioned so far, and there's at least a fourth issue. I wonder if anyone else listening to us right now knows of people who have run high-power amplifiers in their automobile, even if they've done it on HF frequencies, and what kind of issues do they run into. If you've got opinions or prior experience on this subject, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, that would be me, K2KEY, that it be is.
WH4YY. I know somebody who ran 1,000 watts in their car on HF, and he had a definite problem with his car after he got done doing it.
Very fine. So we've had replies now from both Mel and Joe. Mel's done it. Joe knows of someone who's done it. So let's hear some of the good news and the bad news that you ran into, Mel. K2KEY, go right ahead. K2RIW.
Okay, well, I did it. I had a 60 Chevy Impala convertible, and I ran the kilowatt. I was in the military at the time, so I traveled quite extensively down south at the time with the car, down South Carolina and Georgia, eventually out to Texas, and then back again to leave the car back here in New York when I went overseas. But the system was, I had, as you said, I had two 4X 250s in the final. In series, I used the filament, so I had 12 volts for the filament. I had an air scoop system, which was in the trunk of the car that I salvaged from a Cadillac system that used the air conditioning in those days. They had them in the trunk of the car. They had what they call air scoops, one in and one out. That's how the system worked. That was the air circulation system for the amplifier. The amplifier basically supply came from a Leis Nobel. I had a Leis Nobel 100 amp alternator. I had two 6 volt 180 ampere hour what was known as the golf cart batteries in series. And then I had the big selenium rectifier. Those days we didn't have diodes to handle that kind of current, 100 amp current. And I had the big selenium rectifiers in front of the radiator. The transformer I had was a special wound transformer, three-phase transformer, that gave me the 2,000 volts. I mean, this is the outline of the system I had. And I could only run the kilowatt, of course, when the engine was running, Dick, over.
Interesting. Did you ever try running that system without the engine running? And if so, I'm sure you did it very briefly. I think you said you did this on 6 meters, but I'm not quite positive on that one. And when it comes to actually using an amplifier of that kind of power on 6 meters, what kind of response did you get from the people you talked to? Were they saying, boy, as a mobile, I've never heard anybody so loud? Were you working some nice DX? What was it like, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Oh, it was strictly HF, nothing above 10 meters. That's what I ran it at. And no, I couldn't run the amplifier because I needed to lease the valve to produce the three phase into the transformer for the B plus. So what I did have, I had 200 watt exciters in the rig I had in there. That was the NCX5 at the time. I had a 3 and then I put a 5 in. That ran a 200 watt PEP with all true transceiver. Of course, you had room in a car for things like that in those days. And that I could run, shut the engine off and run because I had the batteries, the 12 volts at 180 amperes, the deep discharge, you know, those golf cart monster batteries. And so I could sit with that, but I could only run 200 watts with the engine off. So when I needed the power, I put the kilowatt on. In fact, I used to have antennas where I used to go. I had antennas strung up, and I would just connect them into the mobile, Dick. I had a lot of fun with that setup, but that was the outline of it, basically. It was whole homebrew equipment, and worked out quite well. Ran it for a number of years in the mobile until I got rid of the car. Got rid of the car with the system in it, the lease Naval and the batteries. Gave it to the guy to hold the whole system just the way it was, over.
Impressive. I have seen a YouTube movie of a guy that was running that kind of power, HF, with an antenna that looked like a screwdriver-like antenna. And if you park the automobile under a tree so that the tip of the whip of the antenna was close to a tree branch, he would draw sparks off the end of the antenna. I wonder if at nighttime you ever saw anything like that happen. Mel, go ahead.
No, I never had any problems like that. I never parked it under trees and used it, really. The antenna I used was an antenna called Master Mobile. It was a center loaded with a hefty coil in it made by a company called Master Mobile. And it worked out quite well. I used to get out on the road and sort of course when I was doing 50, 60 miles an hour out in those roads going down south and all with the kilowatts, it worked out extremely well. Very, very satisfied with it, Dick. But it was quite an installation to do, you know. First of all, to get that Lease Naval alternator in there, which was salvaged from a fire truck. It was actually a fire truck that they used it on. My brother took it off a fire truck that they junked it in the yard there when he was in the scrap business. And it was a double belted. Had to change the flywheel and put on a double belted flywheel on the car, and I went through a whole system there and all with the shielding, ignition, and everything. It was a major, major project, but very gratifying when I got it finished, Dick. Over.
Sure sounds like you had fun with that one, Mel. And because that was a 1960 Chevy Impala, and in those days they had a very simple spark gap, you know, points and spark transformer, for the spark plugs. A very simple ignition system, no emission control computer, so you didn't have that problem. Whereas with a modern day machine, with all of that elaborate electronics on board, I think you'd have to use state of the art shielding techniques to make sure that any of the radiation into the 12-volt wiring and anything that gets into the computer, and there's more than one microprocessor on many automobiles these days, any one of them getting heavily interfered with by the RF or current drain or whatever, or even the spikes on the inverter, could give you some grief. So you'd have to be kind of careful. Joe, it sounds like you know somebody who has run a kilowatt from the car. What band was it on? How much trouble did he have? How much fun did he have? To V2RYY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, a fellow we both know by the call of letters from KF2GB. You know him, Jack, right? He runs a ML55 type of SUV that he drives around. For a while, he was running an HF transceiver in the car with a 1001 amplifier in the trunk. He had a problem with conducted emissions, and what it basically did for him was he was running on 20 meters, running sideband, and he had the transceiver, the output of the power of the amplifier, basically shut his car off while he was driving. Actually shut the car off and caused it to not work at all. Nothing worked in the car. Dome lights, nothing. And he had to call a friend of his, not me, of course, to come down and help with the problem. The problem was he had to take the battery lead off the battery and reset the computer in the car because the computer controls everything in the car, and he caused that computer to completely just go dead, stone dead, wouldn't do anything.
I wonder if you passed it back to me, Joe. You suddenly dropped out right after you said the car went stone dead and had to reset the computer. I am curious, Joe, whether or not Jack was able to fix that problem, or did he have to give up the project? What was the ultimate result? W2RYY, T2RIW.
The battery light on my HD is flashing, so it may cut out momentarily. I'm looking myself on the internet also. No, he gave up the idea of running HF in the car because I told him that with the problem of conducted emissions, you may do it again and cause other types of problems with the car, so he doesn't do that anymore. The problem was just never diagnosed as far as what computer actually quit in the car, but it basically took disconnecting the battery to reset the computer in the car. So if anybody else is currently thinking of doing something like that, that's a consideration that may happen to you also.
Very fine, Joe. Do you happen to know what year and what model automobile ran into that problem where the computer had to be completely reset? Back to you, Joe.
Yeah, he drives an ML55. He was in the Mercedes type of SUV. I don't remember the exact car. Somewhere there may be like a 2001, 2002, something like that. Does that help you at all?
Yeah, that is sort of what I wanted to know. A reasonably modern automobile with probably a real emission control computer, obvious by the fact that the computer had to be reset. So, as you can see, running that kind of power from an automobile is not something to take lightly. Yes, it's nice to be king of the hill and run a real potent transmitter and not have people complain about you being weak. But most automobile transmitters run in the 10 to 50 watt category, occasionally a 70 watts. But as you go much beyond that, you can run into some serious problems. And even 50 and 70 watts, if you're not careful, can give you some problems. Up till now, what I've discussed is the current drain from the primary power of the battery and alternator, can it take it? Can the emission control computer take it? Can the radio frequency biohazard standards be met? Is it safe to do it? Whether or not your mag mount can take that amount of power with a piece of RG58 on, say, for instance, 2 meters, you're pushing your luck a little bit, but I think it would take it. There is at least one more factor to worry about. Let me drop. And that is a very subtle effect takes place. If you're running a piece of equipment in your automobile that's going to draw 130 amperes, for instance, most likely you're going to be putting something like a 150 or 200 ampere fuse into that circuit. When you run a fuse at that high a power level, you almost don't have a fuse at all. Let me give you an example. Let's assume that the wire going through the firewall scraped through that grommet and started making a short circuit to ground, the plus 12 volt lead. And let's assume that the plus 12 volt lead made a contact between the wire and the firewall of a tenth of an ohm. By Ohm's law, a tenth of an ohm at 12 volts is going to draw 120 amperes to ground. But you're running a 150 or 200 ampere fuse. Therefore, the fuse is not going to blow. The circuit breaker is not going to open up at only 120 amperes. But 120 amperes at 12 volts is something like 1,400 watts is being dissipated into that short circuit. That tiny little piece of wire making that tenth of an ohm contact the ground is dissipating 1400 watts. Obviously, it can very easily create a fire, and the fuse is not going to protect you. So when you're running those kind of currents at that high a power level through an ordinary fuse or without some kind of very elaborate circuit that can detect faults, you might actually get some failures of the system as if you had no fuse at all. And you could possibly, in the worst case scenario, burn down an automobile. So lots and lots of factors to be considered. And so the man who asked this question was Leslie. I wonder if you know anyone who has tried doing it, Leslie. I wonder if you're considering doing it. I'm not telling you you can't do it. All I'm telling you is that you're climbing a pretty tall mountain to try to, let me drop. To try to do something like that, you're climbing a pretty tall mountain. As such, you got to know where the minefield is, if you know what I mean. You got to know where the problem areas are before you say, aha, I've got success. At least those three or four areas should be heavily addressed, seriously considered. Multiple tests should be conducted to make sure that you've met all the requirements of at least those areas before doing this, in my opinion. So I wonder if you're really contemplating this, Wesley. N2XJN, the guy who asked the high-power question, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, November to X-ray, Juliet, November. Well, I did run 500 watts from SG-235. That was SGC. No, actually, it was the amp was SG-500. And there was the alternator installed that was able to withhold at least 160 amps. But prior to for me to going to all of these details that I did, which was the antenna and backing plates and the problems with RFIs and how much money, usually I can state it's around $5,000 that you are going to spend easily when you try to run 500 watts, not 1 kilowatt. Let me jump for a moment. And I still like the idea. Prior for me to going that, I can state what's available on the market from the old old amplifiers. One of them is ARF1000, which is the Ameritron. And that gives you 1000 watts PEP and 400 watts on CW. Then the other one was the old one, PNH, that was the amplifier that was using tubes, 12JB6, and it was about 500 watts. Now Hitchkit made a very good one in 1965, that was HA14. I, by myself, hold it in my hands, I didn't use it. And they used a pair of 572's GG. There was the popular series of SP100s. The problem with that, this thing did not have a ventilator, how do you say, fan. And you could run... forget about it, it's not enough time. Okay, another one was Metron. This one I never saw, but it looks like it's a good one. Metron was done in the 70s, when Metron 1000B. It's still available, you can still find it on eHam. People was trying to sell it. And it was very good amplifier with modules and combiners, band pass filters, and it was fully remoted. That means you could remotely maneuver that. Another one was Hercules. This Hercules was using MFR 458 finals. And there was a Hercules 1, there was Hercules 2, around 1 kilowatt, if I'm not mistaken. And later on, they modified, these people took it and modified that with transistors with Toshiba 2SC2879, which was the closest replacement. Let me check for a moment. About 1919, Ameritron put ALS 500. I did use this one as well. Good stuff. Very hard to die. It dies on me. Okay. And another one, Henry Radio, the most ugly amplifier ever put, and one of the best ones. One of the favorite ones. Henry Radio, Radio made SS750 and SS1200. And they covered from 160 to 10 meters. Let me drop for a moment. These amplifiers use 14 volts DC and were able to produce 750 watts PAP. And it was really good stuff. The retail price at that time was $1,400 to $2,400. So you gotta imagine, that was absolutely expensive. Some people, they run it on 28 volts, and there was not many problems with this stuff. You put it, it worked. The other one, very well known, was SG500, Power Cube. The Power Cube was covering 160 to 10 meters, no dials, no nothing. You put it, it works. It has a very good current and voltage and SWR overdrive protection. It was working like a horse. One thing, did not have a fan. They have the fan. If you want to have a fan, you could buy it as an option, and it cost you at that time around $220, which we're talking right now about $500, if you would compare the value of the dollar. It was a black box, nice looking, nice working, with full remote if you wanted, and fully automatic. Tokyo Power. Tokyo Power put on the market HL700B. And this one used eight transistors THP120. It was giving around 450 watts, although I've heard about another Tokyo, and I would appreciate if somebody educate me, which actually is 1200 watts and is still available. I didn't get that one. And for the people, they don't want to listen to the history, there is one, I never saw this one, the Messenger M4V. This one was 650 watts, manufactured in 70s. And right now we have one that is available. If one, somebody wants to buy it, I'm going to give the model number. Okay. And this one is being called WM1200. WM1200, you put it to the goggles, you find the manufacturer is American made. It uses 8 power transistor 2SC2879. The frequency range is 1.8 to 21.5. The output is 1200 watts plus on all bands. Driving power is 120 watts with 50 ohm input matching. And the requirements for the DC power is 13 volts at 175 amps. And the end of that, at the end of that monologue of mine, I can state one thing. People say good antenna gives you better benefit than the amplifier, which they're right. So what? You got a good antenna. Then they say, okay, you have a problem with alternator batteries and stuff. Well, I was running in the army 1500 watts, but it was an army truck, so I didn't have a power. There is no time right now to talk about it. Then you're going to have a good ring. Some people say you take TS 2000, you have 100 watts, and you don't want not worry about the antenna tuner and stuff. There is a TS 480, which is 200 watts, and it's beautiful remote console, but doesn't have an antenna tuner. So for what you need, there's the high power. For the same reason, respect the words of Dick. If you go for the amplifier, go maximum that you can get, or don't go at all. Back to you, Dick, and to Exia.
Very interesting. It's obvious, Wesley, you have investigated the situation an awful lot. And to a person who does enough research on the subject, I'm not trying to be discouraging when I tell you all of the potential problems you can run into. Fusing, alternator, survival, current drain, wiring size, biohazard, emission control computer, and whatever. All of these are the degrees of difficulty that must be addressed on a modern-day automobile before you can run numbers like 500 and 1,000 watts from the automobile. I'm not saying these words to discourage anyone. I'm just letting you know where the minefield is and what you've got to address. And the situation, if you are serious, technical enthusiast with a fairly deep pockets, not cheap. Wesley let us know that it's going to be a little bit expensive, but this kind of a situation does separate the men from the boys. If you think you've got the resources, if you think you've got the technology, if you're willing to face each of those problems and solve them, and if you do succeed in putting numbers like 300, 500, 800, or 1,000 watts in your automobile, under certain circumstances, it will allow you to talk further. People will listen to you. You'll be treated with respect as long as you can solve all those problems. So it's a little bit like moon bounce used to be in the old days before there was the Joe Taylor techniques that allowed you to use much lower power. In the old days, in order to get an echo off the moon, you had to put a healthy 1,000 watts output into the antenna. The antenna had to have, on 432 megacycles, for instance, something close to 28 or 30 decibels of gain. You needed a noise figure on the receiver under 1 decibel. You needed feed line losses that are very low. That antenna had 400 square feet of area. So to really set up a operational moon-bound system by the old days, on, say, 432 or 2 meters, really separated the men from the boys. Only one ham per 1,000 could really do that and pull it off, so to speak. Well, putting 1,000 watts in your automobile is of equal degree of difficulty. But if you want a challenge, and if you do succeed in solving all of those problems, let me drop. Most of your fellow amateurs will treat you with a lot of respect. They'll think you walk on water. They'll hear you very well. In the case of, say, for instance, 2 meters or 6 meters, the amount of gain you can put into that antenna on an automobile is extremely limited. You don't have the real estate. You don't have the wavelength to do it. Any antenna with high gain must have multiple wavelengths in at least one of its dimensions, length, width, total area, whatever. There's got to be multiple wavelengths. Well, on 6 meters, one wavelength is, 18 feet or so. You're not going to put a whole lot of wavelengths into an antenna on 6 meters on an automobile. You can make the antenna 98% efficient. It'll radiate all the power you put into it, but it's not going to have a high directivity antenna pattern. You just can't do that. So if you want to really be loud on 6 meters or 2 meters from an automobile, it's going to take some power. And if you're willing to solve the problems, it's an interesting challenge. Go for it, but know ahead of time, it's not going to be cheap. It's not going to be easy, and there's some risk involved. Make sure you know how to reset the computer on your car and what to do if it goes into the throttle runaway condition that we've been hearing about in past weeks. As long as you're willing to face all those situations, I say go for it. Thank you for bringing that to our attention, Wesley. We're going to go on to the next people, and if we got some extra time, we'll come back and discuss that one some more. The next person who signed in was Bob, W2CYK. Hope we haven't lost you, Bob. I hope you're still within range. W2CYK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2CYK, good evening, Dick. Good evening to the net. I'm going to take you offline with you. Just check your email and get back to me. Thanks a lot.
Okay, sounds like you sent me something on email. And in between the next conversation and now, I'll find out what you sent, and maybe I'll get back to you. The next person who signed in after Bob, let's see if my list makes any sense here, was, I think, Irwin. Yes, Irwin, W2TRP. W2TRP, Tango Rodeo, Romeo Popper, if I've got it right. You've got it, Irwin. K2.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Since my wife, Selma, WA2SHC, passed away, I'm trying to get other interests because I'm doing most of the computer work for my veterans groups, and I'm thinking on getting back onto FastScan TV like I did when Ed Pillar and I designed the Limark ATV repeater. And I was just wondering if there's if you know of any activity on FastScan TV.
Yeah, the guy who used to live in Wausau. Why can't I think of his call letters right now? Wonder if you know the guy I'm talking about, Irwin. He used to work in the control tower at Grumman Aircraft in the old days, and I haven't talked to him in a long time. But he was the spark plug for FastScan Television on Long Island. He had all kinds of generators and special effect machines and whatever, multiple cameras. He used to sit in front of a very large screen that had a Hawaiian scene, and he would sit there with his Hawaiian shirt on and put on a real good broadcast show, so to speak, in FastScan Television. W2ORS? Not sure if that's his call letters. He was a major spark plug. Within the sound of my voice right now, if anyone knows of groups doing fast scan television on frequencies like 439 megacycles or 1296 or 900 megs, give me your call letters right now because Irwin would like to know about it. If you know about fast scan television in the Metro New York area, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, I was a little bit afraid of that. If I go to my 3x5 card file that I used to use, Irwin, when I was on 432, I used to keep track of everybody I talked to. There was a total of 450 different people. I would write down the number of microvolts of signal strength they were giving me because I had a calibrated receiver at the time, calibrated with a signal generator, and people would know when they made a change to their antenna, they would send a signal to me and find out how strong their signal was today, and we'd find out how many decibels of improvement they made to their antenna if they went to a higher gain antenna or a higher altitude or whatever. I was slightly involved with Ed Pillar's W2KPQ's amateur television and technical net, which ran in 1975 to 1976. And he did set up a television repeater at a tower in Old Westbury. But that whole project only lasted about a year or two. It took a lot of enthusiasm to do it. So right now I'm not hearing of anyone doing FastScan television. There was a repeater at the World Trade Center. Obviously, it failed when the World Trade Center failed on 9/11/01. So how much ATV activity is left is an interesting question. The two other guys I knew of in the Islip area, I think, are now Silent Keys. And I hope the guy in Wausau is not a Silent Key. In between the next guy who's talking, I'll look up my card file and see if I can find his call letters for you. He was really the local spark plug. He's the best guy to contact. And as you can tell, because it's been so darn many years since I've talked to him, I can't think of his name or call letters. I remember his town, and I know something about what antenna he was using. Back to you for any further comments, Erwin. Haven't heard from you in a long time. Glad to hear you again. W2TRP, sorry to hear about your loss. K2LIW on the second end.
Okay, fine, Dick. I think his call was AQM, if I remember, because I have hanging on the wall right now about 10 newspaper articles that I appeared in. One of them was from, I believe, 73 Magazine, and it was AQM, AQM's picture in there. Now, I'm trying to get my interest back because I've been addicted to computers and all that. And I may just pull my equipment out and see what happens. But thanks a lot. This is W2TRP, turning it back to Dick.
Yeah, there's about a 50-50 chance. I'll find his 3x5 card file in the next 10 minutes, Erwin. So if you can hang in there a little bit later, I'll see if I can give you that information. Let's see now. I think I've gone through all the list of people who signed in with real questions tonight. And if not, if I haven't skipped anyone, then I'm going to go over to Paul. We're going to hear the space report. So let me double check. Have I skipped anyone who signed in who had a question? Give me a call. That is right now. K2LIW on the TechNet. Looks like I didn't. And Paul, what's going on in space? I hope the Kepler experiment, I think that's the one that's looking for exoplanets. I think it's now operational. I believe the last I heard when I went to a conference, let's see, where was it now? I went to a conference on unidentified flying objects that was held a couple of weeks ago at Suffolk Community College. I also went to a conference at Stony Brook University last month. I think it was the beginning of, December. And in both of those, I heard that there's about 300 planets that have been discovered now that are going around stars different than our sun. So they're discovering more and more of them. And the Kepler experiment is one of the things put up by NASA that's specifically looking for exoplanets. So what's the latest in space, Paul? WS2N, our space expert, K2LIW in the TechNet. And don't forget to every 90 seconds or so to reset the machine, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yes, understood, Dick. And yeah, I'm going to try to keep it relatively short. I'm interested in Mel's Ballon topics, so I don't want to drag this out too long. We talk about the present spacecraft quite often, and of course the ones in the past. I just wanted to go over a few that we're going to should be coming up within the next few years. We do this now and then, and then we see how it goes. Sometimes they cancel them. Sometimes they'll double the effort, put out one. Instead of one, they'll put out two of the same thing, like they did with the Mars rovers. So there's manned spacecraft that are going to be going up, and there's orbital spacecraft that are going to be going around Earth, and we have some deep space probes as well. An orbital one for Earth is, for instance, is a GLORY. This is a big, big spacecraft that's going to be launched, and it's going to be studying aerosols and radiation from the, what's coming, what's hitting the Earth and what's going back out. Basically studying the global warming effect. That'll be going up in October 2010. Transmitting on X bands and S bands. It will be solar panels. Let me drop it. Of course, you've got the Russian flights going up one after the other. You're up to Expedition 23 since this thing was launched back in 1999 was the first launch of the space station, space station piece. And since then, you've had now 23 different crews up there, and that will expand for many, many years to come. I'm expecting another, well, they predict a 10-year usage from now, but I know that's going to be extended, like most of these space programs, manned or unmanned, The only one that's been cut short a little bit is the space shuttle. That was supposed to be 100 flights per space shuttle. You know, it's worked out to, going up to 130 total for all the space shuttles. So that's a little bit different. The one I'm interested in is a couple of years from now, Juno. It's going to be a Jupiter mission, launched in August of 2011. Let me drop it. We haven't been out there since Galileo. Galileo was a very successful mission for what it had its problems. The big antenna, the high gain antenna, never opened up on that thing. So they figured out a way of making the small antenna do the work of the big antenna. Of course, it couldn't. You never got the amount of pictures back that you would have gotten with the big antenna. But it worked out where they got, you know, thousands and thousands of pictures and data back from that spacecraft. This one is going to go to Jupiter as well. It'll study the magnetosphere. It'll study the atmosphere of Jupiter. What I like about it is it's not like some of the early predecessors like Pioneer and Voyagers and Ulysses and Cassini and your original Galileo. They were run by RTGs. Let me drop it. The RTGs were power, you know, that was the power source of all these deep space probes, radioisotope, thermal generation. Essentially, you had plutonium sitting in, wrapped in graphite blankets, which would, as the plutonium would degrade, the neutrons would come off, heat up this blanket, and this thing would get hot. And then they had thermocouples, you know, countless thermocouples hooked together in parallel series, and all these different, you know, a thermocouple is just two pieces of metal that are different, that are attached together, and when heated, it gives off a voltage, so you wind up with parallel and series, and eventually you got enough power out of these things to run these spacecraft, in Voyager's case, but definitely.